Welcome to Guided Legacy, where we keep it real about the decisions you make today and how they shape the legacy you leave tomorrow. I'm your host, Dion Tracy Duckett. Today, we're talking about retirement without the fluff, because a lot of people are carrying quiet stress, market fear. Am I saving enough? What if healthcare wipes me out? And how do I make sure my family isn't left with a mess? My guest helps people bring calm and clarity to those exact questions. Daryl Blackman is CSO and Senior Financial Professional at Safe Harbor Benefit Solutions. He spent over two decades helping individuals and families plan around wealth accumulation, protection, and distribution so retirement can feel stable, not scary. Daryl, welcome.
Thank you so much.
I'm glad to have you here. And just an aside, everybody, I've known Daryl since the third grade, so he's a great friend and here to help us today. So, Daryl.
Long time.
Yes. Let's start here. When you meet someone who's anxious about retirement, what are the first red flags that you tell you their plan might look fine on paper, but isn't built to last?
And that is an excellent question, Dion. I think one of the major red flags is, thinking that they have enough money to live a lifestyle they're living currently. You know, people feel like, I'm accustomed to receiving $10,000 a month, and my plan is set up to do that, and it's not necessarily going to be able to accomplish that in retirement, because you, of course, have to account for inflation, healthcare costs, and many other things that will kind of eat at that. So that's one of the major things I tell people, that, you know, let's really kind of dig into these numbers and be realistic and see, you know, what things we are more than likely going to encounter later on and how that's going to affect our income in retirement.
Okay. So what do you think is the biggest misconception that people have about retirement readiness?
Well, along those same lines, I think believing that you have to have millions and millions and millions of dollars to live comfortably in retirement. One of the things that you will notice is, you know, when you listen to a lot of programs, a lot of gurus, you see information, they have a number. You need to have at least $3 million. Well, that really depends upon your lifestyle. And your lifestyle is probably going to change as you get older in retirement. It's interesting because some of my clients that I've started out with in their 50s or now in their 70s and even 80s, and they had these grand plans of traveling the world and doing all these things that were going to take so much money. And now they are just fully loaded with cash because they didn't spend as much as they thought they were going to spend. Okay. So that's probably the biggest misconception. I have to have, you know, millions of dollars in order to be comfortable. That really kind of stresses a lot of people when they focus on that, because that sounds like a big number.
Yeah, it does sound like a big number. So how do you help someone balance growth and risk as they get closer to retirement?
Similar to your business and your industry, Dion, we have our rules of thumb, and one of those rules as it relates to risk and growth is what's called the rule of 100. And so the rule of 100 states that whatever your current age is, if you will subtract that from the number 100, that is the amount of money that you really should start moving into conservative vehicles. And the balance is what you can continue to take some risks with. So, for example, if a person is 60 years old, 60 from 100 leaves 40. 40 is the amount that we can continue to take, you know, a good amount of risk with. 60 is the amount we really need to start moving to conservative vehicles.
Okay, I hadn't heard that one. The rule of 100. So
rule of 100.
All right. What does growing assets while minimizing risk look like in a real life strategy? That's
so
funny.
That is our mantra. That's our focus there. You know, growing your assets while minimizing risk. And if you look at any retirement portfolio or financial portfolio, they generally will have your equities, so your mutual funds, your stocks, and then they will also have bonds. Bonds are there to provide stability, to kind of manage the risk in the portfolio itself. And so one of the ways that we actually grow your assets while minimizing your risk is we say that, okay, we can replace those bonds with other vehicles that can still provide the same kind of stability, but give you a higher return. And so in doing that, the money is growing more than it would be just in a traditional bond strategy, but still, you know, lowering your risk.
And so is there an age when you need to start changing your mix?
Going back to that rule of 100. I mean, you know, when you are, so think about this, Dion. Okay, so the IRS says that at age 59 and a half, that's when you will no longer be penalized for withdrawing tax-deferred monies from a retirement account. So that should give us a signal there. That should let us know, okay, that's what is the conventional wisdom about when you should start thinking about my long-term retirement. And so I would say maybe age 60 is really the point where you really should start looking at that mix very hard. Because what you don't want to do is retire at 65, you know, we experience a market downturn that's lasting longer than what's happening now, and you have to withdraw funds from that account.
Okay. Is there an age, Darryl, that we should start looking at changing our mix as far as our investments?
So going back to the rule of 100, if we think about how the IRS has set everything up, at age 59 and a half, that's when you can take funds out of tax-deferred retirement accounts without penalty. So that should be a signal to us. That, all right, this is when we should really kind of start focusing on migrating some of our money to more conservative vehicles beginning at that particular time. My rule is right around age 60. And I say that because let's say that you plan to retire at age 65. 65 is a good number, but you could actually, we could experience a downturn in the market at that particular time. And you've already started pulling funds out, you could really deplete your assets very quickly because you've already set up your lifestyle to receive money at 65. And so that's why we want to make sure we have a good portion of our money at that point into the conservative vehicle so we're not as concerned about what happens with the market during that time.
Okay. Okay. And so what would you say are some of the top threats to retirement security right now?
You know, the usual suspects, inflation and health challenges. I mean, if you think about it, Dion, I mean, okay, so we've known each other since third grade, we say. You know, back in those days, you could purchase a vehicle, a brand new vehicle for $5,000. Fast forward here in 2026, that same level vehicle now costs $40,000. So inflation is there, it's rampant, it's active, it's going to happen. The value of the dollar is not what it used to be. And so that's going to continue more into retirement. So inflation is a big issue. And then, of course, health challenges, because health challenges, if not properly planned for, can also devastate a retirement account. If there's no provisions in place to account for potential health challenges, you could really just have worked all these years, amassed this money in your retirement account, and now you're just simply turning around using that money to pay for health care.
Exactly, and that's some of the things that we look at when people are planning and wanting to save to leave a legacy behind for the next generation. How often do you see that in your field where the health challenges kind of decimate what they've put into place?
quite often, Dion. It's very common, which is why I've made that a part of, you know, my education. When I'm speaking with people regarding retirement, I'm also saying, you know, let's plan for potential long-term care issues. You know, there have been plenty of studies done that say that about 70% of all retirees after the age of 65 will need some type of care. So because we statistics are telling us that, we can plan for it. We can go ahead and prepare for it. I have seen issues where, you know, people have not done any type of planning and they have just gone down very quickly, and because there wasn't a plan in place, my only resort is to use my Social Security check, to use my pension check, to use money from my other retirement plan to pay for care. And you and I both know, I mean, care can be very, very, very expensive.
Very expensive. And most people, you know, feel like we're not going to go to the nursing home. We don't want to go to the nursing home, but many people end up having to do that. And, yes. You know, right now I know in Georgia, on average, it's $10,000, $13,000 a month. So
crazy.
Yeah.
And the thing about it, Dion, is a lot of times that is not, you know, you would assume paying $10,000, I'm getting supreme care, and that's not necessarily the case.
Correct.
Because the industry, long-term care industry, is really hurting for, you know, solid individuals to come and work with their clients in those particular facilities. And so a lot of them are still getting poor care, paying $10,000 a month. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Wow. Do you think that's worse now? Is that something that's new, or is that the way it's been?
It's gotten progressively worse over the years because, you know, those facilities, you know, they have a certain wage that they're going to pay for a position like a CNA, you know, or some other type of assistant. And we know now that because things are so expensive, food costs are so high, you know, fuel costs, insurances, housing, all of these different things, you know, a lower salary is just not going to cut it. And so many of those people opt to do something different in order to earn more income, as opposed to going working in a facility like that. It's happening across the board. I mean, it's a lot of industries, but definitely this one.
Okay. Yeah, I see it a lot in the courts, everywhere, and there's so much turnover. So that's, you don't want it in your health care.
Right. Exactly. Especially paying $10,000 a month. If I pay $10,000 a month for anything, it needs to be top of the line.
Exactly.
I mean, come on.
Exactly. So what's one move you think people can make this month to reduce anxiety and increase control?
So one of the things about reducing anxiety, increasing control, is to become laser beam focused on eliminating bad debt. See, it's a much better feeling when you have income coming in, you have savings, you have money in your retirement plan, and you have a lot of debt versus you having those things and having no debt. And so that's one of the things that you can do immediately. Put a plan in place to eliminate any bad debt, and that will give you the peace of mind, that will give you the comfort, that will reduce the anxiety, and you'll feel like you're more in control of the situation.
Okay, so up next, we're gonna talk about income, because having savings is one thing, but having a plan that produces dependable income is a different game. So stay with us. Welcome back to Guided Legacy with Dion Duckett. Want more of what you're watching? Stay connected to this show and every Now Media TV favorite, live or on demand, anytime you like. Download the free Now Media TV app on Roku or iOS and unlock nonstop bilingual programming in English and Spanish. On the move? Catch the podcast version at www.nowmedia.tv. From business and news to lifestyle, culture, and beyond, Now Media TV is streaming around the clock, ready when you are. Welcome back to Guided Legacy. I'm here with Daryl Blackman from Safe Harbor Benefit Solutions, and we're getting into what most people really want but don't know how to build, a retirement paycheck. So, Daryl, you've said retirement income is one of the biggest challenges retirees face, especially when retirement can last decades. So how do you build an income plan that's designed for real life, not just a spreadsheet?
Another excellent question. I try to make this very simple, Dion. It's a math problem. We determine how much money we believe we're going to need in retirement. Usually, it's a portion of our current income. So let's say you're, as an example, your current income is $100,000. And you believe in retirement, you know what? I won't have a car note. My children are gone. I probably won't need as much money. I only need about $80,000 a year, let's say. And so we take that $80,000 and we backfill it with whatever guaranteed sources of retirement we have. So if we receive a pension, and let's say that that pension is, $40,000 a year. Well, that's $40,000 of the $80,000. You're going to receive Social Security. Let's say Social Security would be another $30,000. Got $30,000, now we've hit $70,000, we're about $10,000 off our number. And so there is where we need to figure out, how do we make up that $10,000? And I actually, whatever number they give me, I always put a cushion in there. Like I said earlier, for inflation and for healthcare challenges.
Okay.
And so I'm probably going to be shooting for about $90,000. So we need to figure out, how do we make up that other $20,000? We look at whatever other resources they have, and then we build that part into the plan. So it's really a math problem.
Okay. And so what are the most common mistakes people make when they try to do it yourself, retirement income?
Mm-hmm. What I have experienced is many people that do it themselves base their retirement plan on an ever-rising stock market. Now, I know we are in some uncharted territory right now. We have experience year after year after year of growth in the stock market. You know, the Dow Jones is 50,000 plus. The S&P is at the highest it's ever been. And so people are accustomed to that. But the thing about it is, Dion, none of that is guaranteed. At any moment, something could happen, something could occur. It has happened before throughout history where, those gains that we're seeing now have actually become, declines, have become losses. And the challenge is, if you don't prepare for that, if you just think it's going to continue to go up, you begin to establish your lifestyle based upon an ever-growing market. And if there is a downturn and you base your lifestyle on a higher amount, now by pulling money out of my portfolio, because this is how my lifestyle is set up, I could drastically deplete my account. We call it a sinking fund. And you have to be aware of what's called sequence of returns, because if I'm up 10% and then I'm down 10%, I've got to get 15% to get back to where I was. And so many people are kind of setting their lifestyle up on that, and that's a big mistake. The second thing, and we're going to harp on this all throughout this interview, not accounting for potential health issues. Health issues can erode your entire retirement account. It happens all the time.
Yeah, and it can sneak up on you.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and how do you, we talked about the inflation, and we've been seeing a lot of that. How do you plan for inflation without chasing risk?
So many of the plans that we use with our clients, they have built-in inflation adjustments, because we know that this is something that we need to do, whether it's one of our long-term care plans, whether it's one of the personal pension plans we put in place, they will generally have an inflation adjustment component in the plan itself for income, because we know $2,000 or $5,000 today is not going to be the same, have the same buying power 10 years from now. That, along with the cost of living adjustment that's provided through Social Security, those two things together can help offset inflation.
And I heard you mention the long-term care planning. And that's something that I deal with, but I think probably the best way is to plan financially versus having to do that with your estate plan. And so what age do you think that people need to start looking at that?
You know, it's, I would say just before retirement. And it's funny because you got two things that you're looking at. You're looking at, actually three. You're looking at, of course, when you're planning to retire, you're looking at, of course, what age you are. And then you're also looking at, you know, what is going to be the best route for me to do that? Is it going to be a traditional long-term care plan where I'm, it's very rigid as far as underwriting and my health and that sort of thing? Or am I looking at an asset-based plan, which really is just about me putting money to the side for it? And those things are important because, you know, a person's health can change on a dime, as you just mentioned. You know, if you try to ride it out and say, oh, well, you know, I'm not going to do anything at 55. I'm going to wait till 65. Well, your health may change drastically during that 10-year period. So to answer your question, I know it was a roundabout way to answer your question, but I'm saying I think you should really seriously start looking at about age 55.
Okay.
Because that can be, you know, it's something about when people hit that 65 mark, you know, things just start kind of popping up health-wise, and it usually just progresses from there. So we don't want to wait to that one.
And does that make it more difficult to get the long-term care planning done? Okay.
Yes. Okay. Makes it more difficult or, you know, more costly.
Okay. And so what if you're a healthy 65?
So if you're a healthy 65, you can, of course, get a plan. It will be less expensive than an unhealthy 65-year-old, but it's still going to be more expensive than it was at 55.
So, Darryl, I work with a lot of people who are doing their estate planning, and they're already in their 70s, and they haven't thought about long-term care planning, and they may have been relatively healthy. Is there still something that they can do as far as planning? Is there some type of vehicle, or are they just too old now to get something?
So that's a great question. They may be too old for a traditional long-term care plan where you would actually have a monthly benefit and you know, different types of features and benefits there. They would be geared more towards an asset-based plan where basically you are earmarking some funds for long-term care. And if the situation arises, you have something that you can draw from. If it doesn't arise, it just continues to grow and can be passed along to your family. The major benefit of doing it that way is the growth in the account is not subject to taxes. And so you've got a very good situation there where you can, you know, if you need it again, it's there, it's great, it's available for you. But if not, I have this account that's growing and it can be passed along to my heirs and I can, you know, really kind of sidetrack taxes. So yeah, there are some options available.
Okay. I think that's a good option because a lot of times with insurance, it's kind of a use it or lose it thing, right?
And it is.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so I've had my older couples come in often when they had long-term care insurance or something, and then one of the spouses decided they were tired of paying for it. And then, of course, something happens to that spouse and they need it. And there's nothing they can do. So that's a nice option to be able, if you don't use it, you can pass it down.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's our go-to plan for people in that situation. And they're more comfortable with that a lot of times.
So how do you help someone minimize risk while still moving forward financially.
So going back to what we spoke about earlier, the rule of 100, you know, we are structuring a plan for less risk. However, we're still keeping some assets and vehicles that will provide growth. And so we're not just simply, you know, completely walking away. I mean, you have some individuals that are like, look, you know, Dara, I've got $1 million. I've hit this number. I don't want to lose any of it. Let's put all of it into a conservative vehicle. And I will ask them over and over and over, are you sure that's what you want to do? And they will say, yes, that's what I want to do. I want to ensure I'm okay with not getting a super high return because I never want this account to go below $1 million. And so it's a personal preference thing, but our goal is to set it up where we're getting the best of both worlds.
Okay. And so what should couples plan for that they often don't?
Very tragically, couples do not prepare for the unexpected loss of a loved one or loss of a partner. Because consequently, that could be a loss of an income stream. You know, if we're sitting down and we're planning with couples, and one or both of them has a pension, they've got Social Security, they have 401ks or some other plans, and again, the lifestyle is set up on those particular assets or those income streams. So when the, you know, let's say the husband goes out of the picture and he was the one that had the pension, well, the pension either may reduce, you know, for the spouse, or it may just go away altogether. So that is a change in income. And couples generally don't think about that because they don't want to think about it. And that makes sense. I mean, but it is something that you have to take into account. And we make sure in our planning that we discuss that with the couples.
Okay. And Daryl, one more question before we break. What's a simple framework viewers can use to sanity check their plan?
Great question, Dion. So going back to what we spoke about earlier, a simple way to do that is calculate your annual amount that you would like to receive in retirement. It is generally a percentage of your current income. Going back to that $100,000 example, I earn $100,000 while I'm working. I want at least $80,000 in retirement. You divide that number by 12, you subtract each projected guaranteed income source for retirement, which can be a pension, Social Security, annuity payments, life insurance payments, whatever it is that you have coming in, and then that will let you know how close you are or how far you are from hitting your number that you want to receive in retirement.
Okay. Well, you're sharing a lot of good information with us, Daryl. For someone who's watching, who wants a smarter income strategy, what's the best first step to take?
The best first step to take is gather all your information and contact my office. And we can sit down and have a no-cost consultation. We'll have a discussion about your goals. We'll look at what you're doing currently, and we can devise a plan that I believe will be very suitable to you and your lifestyle headed towards retirement.
And how would they contact your office?
Excellent question. So you can contact us by phone, of course. The telephone number is 678-824-5077. 678-824-5077. You can also go to our website. The website is safehbs.com. safehbs.com, and you can, of course, reach us on all social media.
Okay, sounds good. Up next, we're talking about legacy planning. So because retirement isn't only about you living well, it's also about what you leave protected. Welcome back to Guided Legacy. A lot of families don't lose wealth because they didn't earn it. They lose it because they didn't protect it. Daryl, you work with families on wealth protection and planning for life changes, including extended care costs. What does a protected legacy require, especially for families who want to be smart, not complicated?
You know, from a financial standpoint, you of course want to have everything spelled out. And you want to do that way ahead of time. And when I say everything spelled out, meaning if I have any type of accounts that allow me to name a beneficiary, I want to make sure that those are updated. You know, it's interesting, Dion. I have seen situations where, you know, a person, maybe a federal employee, you know, they're working, they've been working for 30 years, they set up their benefits, you know, when they started in their 20s, they're now in their 60s, and their lifestyle has changed. They've, you know, divorced and remarried, but they never updated their benefit information, beneficiary mm-hmm. information. And now they may have remarried. Let's say that they decease. Well, if they decease, whoever is named on that plan as the beneficiary is going to receive the benefit. It doesn't matter by court order. It doesn't matter about, because that's a contract between the individual, the owner, and also the company. And so I have seen these type of scenarios where, you know, it's just tragic because this was not put in place properly. So the first thing is any accounts, make sure that the beneficiary information is correct. And then the next stage, of course, would be probably more in your wheelhouse, establishing, of course, a will and or a trust so that you can specify what you want to happen specifically. You know, if it's, hey, I want to leave, you know, a charitable gift for my church. I would like to leave a gift for Breast Cancer Foundation or some cause that you actually have a heart for. Spelling out all of that is to, you know, is to your benefit and to your family's benefit and to whoever you're trying to leave money for's benefit. Because you want to make sure that Uncle Sam doesn't eat everything up, because he will. You know, if you don't have things specified, he will eat it up. Or if you don't have things specified, they can kind of get, you know, lost in the system. You know, we've had situations where, you know, clients who were planning to meet with us and planning to meet with maybe an attorney we have a relationship with, and they just kept putting it off. And then something happens. They have a heart attack. They have a stroke. They're now incapacitated and are unable to make decisions. And because they didn't do that early enough, now there's a challenge. There's a big process that has to be done. So all of those things can be prevented by doing some early planning and making sure you have your T's crossed and your I's dotted.
Right. I think that incapacity planning that you talked about is the biggest thing that people leave out when they do their planning. When they do estate planning, they're just thinking about what happens to my stuff when I die. But and so you've got to plan for the incapacity. So
yes, because you know, you may not just die outright.
Right.
You know, you may you know, become, you know, a vegetable or, you know, there are many people that are dealing with dementia. I mean, I'm hearing more and more about it each day, even though there's new, you know, medical innovations and new medicines and new, you know, processes that they're working on. They still have not cured it. And it is running rampant. That's why you have so many, you know, mental, care facilities, mental care facilities now, mm-hmm. you know, where they're actually focused strictly on dementia patients. And so, you know, you may not just die outright.
Right. We're living longer, but we're having more issues because of it, or not necessarily.
Right. And it's costly. That's the other
yes.
part.
Yes. Yes.
You know? I mean, so. Yeah.
What does legacy planning include beyond having a will?
Dion, it also includes life insurance and preservation of assets. You know, commonly when older family members reach their late 70s and they're not as active as they were, and they're therefore not usually spending as much money. And so these family members, you know, again, they prepare to have all of this money come to them in retirement because they had these grand plans. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that, I'm going to do this. And as you get older, you know, it's funny, in our industry we have, you know, kind of like some jargon that we use when we're referring to different ages. So 60s, when you retire, those are like your go-go years, you know, where you're out there and you're really just, you know, and hey, I don't have to work anymore. Let me do everything that I have been wanting to do my entire life. And so that's how the 60s roll. When you get to 70s, the 70s are considered, when we call this, your slow-go years. So you begin to slow down a little bit, you know, for most people. Now, you still have the, you know, the exceptions. You still have the people that are very spry, usually ladies, you know, that have a lot of energy, and you're able to travel across country to go see the grandkids. And, you know, so you have, you know, you're still an exception, as I said, to the rule. But most people in their 70s are kind of slowing down a little bit. And then your 80s are what's called your no-go years, where you're not really doing as much, if much at all. You know, you're really just kind of staying around the house. You're maybe going to, you know, a center or something like that. You may be going out to eat, seeing the family, so you're not doing very many things. So where I'm going with this is you have money that's just accumulating in accounts, okay? And your objective may be, well, I'm going to leave these accumulated assets to my family. You know, they don't really know exactly what I have coming in, but I've got $10,000 coming in from this. I've got my Social Security. I've got this coming in, and I'm not using very much of it. So it's just accumulating. My objective is to transfer this to my family upon death. But then that old thing that we talked about earlier, health issues creep in. Mm-hmm. And health issues creep in. And now the entire picture changes. Now that money that I was planning to use, leave for my family, I've now got to use for my health care. And I could exhaust the monies that I had that I was planning to save for the family. And so, again, all of this goes into planning, Dion. If we were to make provisions for this happening, potentially happening, you know, having a decline in health, and making sure that our income, our retirement income plan is set up properly, then these scenarios don't blindside us. And we're able to continue the legacy that our family wants to have. Same thing with, you know, taking out life insurance. You know, of course people say, oh, well, when you're younger, that's the best time to buy life insurance, when I'm younger and I'm in better health. I have clients, Dion, that have purchased, you know, in their 20s and 30s, when they were really kind of, you know, making their wealth, have purchased, you know, $3, $4, $5 million policies. And so now as they get older, those policies have either accumulated a lot of cash or they're still in place and they know that, okay, this is something that I know my spouse or my family members are going to receive upon my death. And I did this the right way. And it's going to transfer to them tax-free. So a lot of different things you can do there in the legacy planning.
Okay. Well, this is all good information. Okay, Daryl. So how do extended care costs threaten retirement plans?
Dion, this is a real concern. And I'm glad that at Safe Harbor, you know, we make this a focus of our retirement income planning. Healthcare costs are rising uncontrollably. You and I spoke about earlier how it's not unrealistic to have a $10,000, you know, bill to stay at a nursing home or an assisted living facility or somewhere, you know, where I can get care that I need. And if there's no provision in your retirement plan for healthcare costs, like we've spoken about earlier, it can exhaust your accounts. A lot of people still believe that if I get into a healthcare situation, the government is going to pay for my long-term care, and that is simply not the case. I have a lot of personal experience with this issue. I have clients that have, that own assisted living facilities, and they actually have clients that they take care of. I have had some personal experience with family members where I've had to try to scramble to, you know, get them the type of care that they needed because they went down so quickly. I've had clients that, you know, have experienced that as well. And so this is a very, very, very real concern. And it should be on anyone's radar that is preparing for retirement.
Okay. And then I think those are really big issues. And I think we're all seeing it, or those of us who are reaching our 50s and 60s, and we have parents who are dealing with those concerns. I know my father struggled with Alzheimer's, and my mother's that person in her 80s who's at home not doing a lot. You said the no-goes. Yeah, yes. She's got knee issues.
Yes.
So, what conversations do you think families should have before a crisis hits?
Yeah, you know, those can be very difficult conversations because a person who has been independent their entire life and now just thinking about I have to be dependent, you know, they may not want to, they may resist having those conversations, but you as the child of a parent or you know, a family member that is approaching those upper ages, that conversation has to start with, has there been any type of provision made in the event, you know, mama, daddy, auntie, whoever, we're not saying that this is going to happen, but just in case it does, because it is a reality, you know, is there any type of provision in place for the unexpected? And this will hopefully lead to more questions and ultimately an open discussion where you can do some planning. I'm very encouraged because I had a client the other day that contacted me and he said, hey, I want you to sit down and come talk to my brothers and sisters and my mom. My mom is 85 and we realized that some things have to change now. And we had a nice little family meeting. I was just kind of the facilitator. I let them do all the talking, and I just kind of, you know, posed some different questions. And we left there with a great plan for the mother. And so those are the kind of things that have to happen, but it all starts with asking that family member, is there any provision? What normally happens, Dion, if there isn't, is that falls on, more than likely, the daughter. And so the daughter, who may still be, who may be married, who may be still taking care of children, either minor children or adult children, in their household, that just kind of puts them into what's called the sandwich generation, where now they're caring for older parents and still have people there in the household with them. And, you know, women already have enough on their plates. And so this could just be something else that's added to it. You can address this proactively by having that discussion.
And I like the idea about the family conversation. And one of the things my family, up until COVID, starting in third grade, we always went to Hilton Head for vacation, and the extended family, my cousins, aunts, uncles, it was kind of like a family reunion every year. And now that my generation is older, one of the things that we've tossed around is when we get there, you know, there could sometimes be up to 40 people there, is having some of these conversations about estate planning and insurance and that type of thing. Do you see that happening? Maybe, you know, at people's family reunions or things like that, where they're starting to have those conversations, or what do you think about that?
I actually, myself and one of my colleagues, we've actually spoken at a couple of family reunions, just kind of, you know, not anything too heavy or too serious, but just really kind of posing the questions and you know, leaving some food for thought. I would like to see a lot more of it. You know, I have seen some, but I would like to see a lot more of it because we get together for everything else. And the challenge is, if we don't have these conversations up front, then we are being very reactive when things happen. And usually when you're reactive in anything, you don't make the best decisions. And so right. all of that can be avoided by addressing it up front.
Okay. And then so, Daryl, what does wealth protection look like for someone who's not ultra wealthy?
Great question. The go-to historically has been to accomplish wealth protection with life insurance. And when you think about the nature of life insurance itself, it is designed for some very specific reasons. It could be to replace income in the event, you know, the breadwinner is out of the picture. It can be used to provide legacy for the next generation. It can be used to supplement retirement. So there are a lot of different things it can be used for to actually provide that wealth protection, but you don't have to have hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to actually put plans in place. You know, we in the industry, we coined the phrase, you're trading pennies for dollars. Because we don't know what the future holds, because we know that things can happen at any time, you know, we can use this particular vehicle to accomplish the wealth protection goals that we have. And today's insurance has a lot of built-in provisions that the older insurance didn't have. Now it has what's called living benefits. And so those living benefits could be, you know, the value of the policy can be accessed while you're living in the event of a terminal illness diagnosis, in the event of, you know, a critical illness situation. You have a heart attack, a stroke, invasive cancer, need a transplant, any of those things that a lot of people deal with. You know, you can now access that. And the benefit of doing that is if I can access that policy, now I don't have to use all of my other funds, you know, that I've been saving for retirement or have been saving to transfer to my heirs. And so there are a lot of benefits of doing it that way, and it's usually the most cost-effective way to do it.
Okay. And what I'm getting from all of this is that a legacy doesn't happen by accident. It's built based on your decisions, and you have to have the courage to plan ahead.
Absolutely.
Okay. Absolutely. Well, I think
yeah, you know, we spend money on so many other things.
We do.
You know, so why not? Why not spend the time and the money to ensure that your legacy would carry on?
Exactly. And that's something we've got to wrap our minds around. So we're coming up on our final segment. And when we come back, we're going to focus specially on federal employees and anyone navigating benefits, how they can incorporate what you've earned into a bigger plan that works. Welcome back to our final segment of Guided Legacy, Daryl. I want to talk to the federal employees watching because benefits are powerful, but they can also be confusing. Daryl, you help federal employees incorporate benefits into an overall financial plan so they can retire with clarity and confidence. What are the biggest opportunities people miss simply because no one ever explained how the pieces fit together?
Excellent question, Dion. Excellent question. You know, I've been working personally with federal employees since 2010, and I have hundreds of clients all over the country. We were just talking about doing presentations. I have probably in that time frame done over 800 presentations.
Wow.
To federal employees. And it amazes me how many of them still are not quite clear on how their benefits work and how they can be incorporated into a financial plan. You know, if you have an overall financial plan, which accounts for retirement, what accounts for wealth accumulation, wealth protection, and wealth distribution, your federal benefit plan fits into each one of those categories. So the accumulation part is, of course, you know, you getting time on the job, you advancing as far as obtaining other positions and getting raises, and then, of course, you amassing money in your thrift savings plan, which a lot of people need guidance in that particular area. The protection portion would lean more towards the life insurance that's provided through the job, the health insurance, the other benefits that can affect your wealth, the money that you've earned over the years and have tried to put aside to prepare for retirement. And then the distribution portion, of course, when I do retire, what is the most efficient way for me to access these monies? You know, the federal employees retirement plan is what we call a three-legged stool. You have the pension that's being offered by the federal government, you have Social Security, and then you have the thrift savings plan, which is the equivalent of a 401k plan. And whatever you've done with those three vehicles, that determines how you will live in retirement. And so it amazes me how people don't start looking at that until they get closer to retirement. And at that point, you know, it may or may not be a challenge to fit that into an overall financial plan. So there's a lot of opportunity there because people are just not paying attention to it. I know they're busy. They've got a lot going on. And so, you know, that's pretty common across the board, not just federal employees. People not necessarily thinking about retirement or thinking about the day-to-day.
Okay. And so what would you say are the first things the federal employee should review when they're planning for retirement?
The very first thing that all federal employees should look at is what's called their SCD, and that is an acronym for Service Computation Date. This is the date that the federal government says is your actual start date with the government. And that is the date that they use to calculate any pension benefits that you are going to receive over time, any benefit that you're going to receive as a federal employee is going to spur off that date. And so that's important because sometimes it does, you know, it's the federal government. It's huge. And so there could be mistakes that are made. You know, oftentimes you have military veterans that either retire from the military or they, you know, maybe they didn't go the entire 20 years, they went 10 years. And now they go work for the federal government. And so they have the opportunity to do what's called a military buyback, where they can buy back the time they spent in the military. And now that goes towards their service credits as a federal employee. Well, sometimes that figure is wrong. You know, you paid for 10 years, they only credit you for 8 years, your calculation is off. And so you want to make sure that that is correct, because that can affect how your pension is calculated. Highly important.
Okay. And so Darryl, how do you help someone connect benefits to real life goals like their income, protection, legacy? How do you help them make that connection?
Well, we look at the entire picture, Deanna. We look at the entire financial picture. What is your current income? What assets do you have? How much are you contributing to your voluntary retirement plan? What type of debts do you have? You know, what are the timelines as far as you know, when you would like to retire or when you would like to take Social Security? What are the federal benefits that you are or aren't taking advantage of right now? And from that information, you know, we can develop a plan to help them achieve their goals. But we need all the information, whatever. You know, many times you have federal employees that, you know, they worked somewhere else before they came to the federal government. And so if there's something from the former job that can be used to help in your financial plan, we want to know that information. So all of this has to be gathered. You know, how is your health? All of those things are information that's needed in order to craft a plan that can address, you know, your retirement income, your protection, and then ultimately your legacy.
Okay. And so with your federal workers that you've worked with, what mistakes have you seen that cost federal employees the most over time?
Another great question. And I see these, I have seen these two mistakes over and over throughout the years. Although it does appear now, because the information is out, that I see less of it. But one of the major mistakes is federal employees not obtaining a life insurance plan outside of the government if they are able. Picture this, Dion. The federal government is the world's largest employer, okay? Almost about 2 million employees. Now, since they did all the cuts back in the day, I don't know what that number is now. but it used to be around 2 million people, including the military. All of their benefits are based upon a group. And so just like in group health insurance, you have healthy people and you have unhealthy people. And together they make up a group, and the premiums are determined by the balance of that group. The same thing happens with federal employees as far as life insurance is concerned. Because it's a group plan, any employee has the ability to obtain coverage. And so you have people that have AIDS, you have people that have severe diabetes, you have people that have other type of chronic medical issues, and then you have healthy people on this other side, and all of them are paying the same premiums. So we always say, okay, if you are in good health, you probably do not want to put as much into that plan there on the job. You want to have your own outside plan, because that difference in cost is what you can use to put towards your 401k or your TSP. As an example, there was a client that I was working with that was a nurse. She had started at the VA hospital in her 20s. She actually retired in her early 70s, so almost a 50-year career. During that particular time, she had taken out the life insurance when she started. And over the years, and I'm saying this because their life insurance progressively increases in cost. As your income increases, your coverage increases, the cost increases. And so what she started out paying about $10 a pay period for ended up being almost $1,100 a month when she reached retirement. And there was really, you know, because she had begun to have some medical issues, there was really nothing else that I could move her to, and it was eating up the majority of her pension check. And I said to her, I said, well, you know, you're giving up a lot of money just to have this coverage. And she said, well, Dara, I've been paying on it so long, somebody has to benefit from it. And so she elected to continue to do that. That's a big mistake for most people. And then the second thing is, not contributing enough money to their thrift savings plan. As I mentioned earlier, the retirement is a three-legged stool. Pension, Social Security, TSP. The former federal employees that worked before 1984 received a traditional pension. They didn't get Social Security. And so they could get up to 80% of their income. If they made $100,000, the government would pay them $80,000 in retirement. That was a good deal. Fast forward after December of 1983, now the onus was put on the employee to contribute to the TSP. And so some people say, oh man, the old employees had a great plan. But really and truly, if you play your cards right, you could have more money in retirement doing this way, because I've seen some TSP accounts that have $7 million in over a 30-year career. And so by not putting money into that TSP and leaving it alone, not using it as a line of credit, not every time I get into a challenge pulling from it, but leaving it alone, contributing as I get raises and increasing the amount I'm contributing, those are ways that can benefit me long term. But Those are things that some people are just not doing. So that's a big mistake.
Yeah, and that applies not just to the federal employees, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And so I think we've come to our time. And Daryl, I really want to thank you for being with us today and bringing clarity to something that impacts every family, how we protect what we've built and live with more peace of mind. So to everyone watching, a strong legacy isn't just about earning. It's about planning, protecting, and staying ready for real life.